On January the 7th, when on that Sunday morning I preached a message on John the Baptist, and I preached here on a Sunday morning and about how John the Baptist was in prison, and he sent his disciples to ask Jesus, how are you the one? I mean, he's hearing about all these miracles happening, and nothing has happened for him. He's still in prison. And he sent the message to Jesus, are you the Christ, or should we wait for another? He's looking for a miracle. And in that message, I made several statements. Now, usually when I preach a message, it's something God has applied to my heart. It's something that I've kind of lived through. But this message was different because I hadn't lived through that. And it was kind of backwards. And what God was doing was preparing me and my family to walk through something. And so from now on, I'm just going to preach health and wealth messages. just good, flowery. But that, I remember making some statements in that message, and they sounded really good to me at the time. And here's a few of those. Miracles are overrated. They're not for everyone or for every situation, which is true. And that was a very flippant statement for me to make. We often make the appearance of a miracle the litmus test for our faith. I'd ask the question, are you in prison, in the prison of anger, waiting for God to do something for you? Another statement, sometimes God, his only response to us is to call our attention to the work he's doing around us and not for us. And then I ask the question, what if God does not give you a miracle? And that question would haunt me later on. Will you be satisfied and at peace with that if there is not a miracle? And the last statement I made in that message, you'll be blessed if you accept the answer that Jesus gives you and are at peace with that answer. And so I preached that message, and then a week later on that Sunday, Kristen, or Britton, came home from a camp and she was sick. We didn't know that she had the flu. We kind of suspected that. And she kind of suspected that. The next day we would send her to the clinic and they would test her and she would be tested positive for the flu. And she would even write to her boyfriend about on that day about how she thought she had the flu, and they were texting back and forth. And she made the statement, she said, so here's the plan. Tomorrow I'm going to go to the clinic. And they're going to tell me that I'm dying and they'll take me to the hospital. I will stay in the hospital for a month. By the way, she stayed there 31 days. And every day you will come to visit me. Now, he didn't do that every day. He tried. He would have loved to, but, you know, he's got a life and all. And said, you will, and we will talk. She said, well, you will talk because I will not be able to. Well, she's just being flippant. But that little text, she showed that to me later on. I was like, wow, you know, that she kind of saw that kind of coming there. So on that Monday, Kristen took her to the clinic, and sure enough, she had the flu, brought her home, started the Tamiflu treatment, and then Tuesday, I stayed home with her. That was our 25th wedding anniversary, that Tuesday. We had plans for that weekend. We were going to be going to New Orleans. I'm going to stay at a nice hotel there. We had the Commander's Palace all lined up, and we were ready to go for New Orleans, and so I'm thinking, really, she's got to get the flu this week. Well, maybe she'll be done with that, and we can go on, you know, to have our weekend away at New Orleans. And then the next morning would change everything. The night before, that Tuesday, you know, she was very lethargic, and the whole day I'd been telling her she needs to drink more fluids. I said, if you don't drink fluids, I'm gonna take you to the hospital. They're gonna put an IV in your arm, you know, just, you know. And and her fever would go up and come down, and we didn't realize that was a really bad sign for what's called septic shock. That was beginning to take effect in her her body. Monday, her lungs were clear. There was no problems. Tuesday, she started developing a cough. Her stomach got upset. You know, she lost her lunch, and it was just kind of an odd day. Tuesday, that night we watched a movie called While You Were Sleeping, about a guy who ends up in ICU for several weeks And it's really a funny movie about some, and he has amnesia when he wakes up. Interestingly enough, on Wednesday, her grandmother would develop amnesia. She had an amnesic episode. It was just kind of bizarre that that would happen on that very day that her granddaughter was going in the hospital. So Wednesday morning came, and I was getting ready for work, and Kristen came in. She said, look, Britton is in really bad shape here. And she said, we've got to get her to the doctor now. I said, well, get her dressed. I'll get her to the ER. And so she got her dressed. I put her in the car. We drove to the ER, and I walked her in. It was 21 degrees on the thermometer in my car. We walked in the ER, and there was nobody in there. We were the only people in there. She sat down in the little chair, and the guy starts taking her vitals. He said, we're going to get you back and to the room back there. So we get in the back, and Dr. Gonzalez comes in. He's the ER doctor, and he says, well, it looks like she's a little dehydrated. We're going to get some fluids in her, probably send her home. So they began the process of trying to get fluids in her, and it took 8 tries for them to finally hit a vein, and it took an ultrasound machine for them to finally get the IV in the vein. And so as things began to develop in the ER, and unbeknownst to us what was going on, and Kristen had gotten there, she'd gotten dressed and gotten there, you know, the nursing staff was starting to get a little concerned. One of the nurses noticed something in when she had you know, spit up a little bit, and I know she's over there kind of, you know, with her finger kind of in gloves, and she's kind of looking, and she walks out, and Dr. Gonzalez comes back and he says, you know, we're going to keep her overnight. Just a precaution. We just want to just observe her, make sure everything's okay. I looked at Kristen and said, well, I'll go home, get her some stuff, and I'll come back. So I went home, loaded up some stuff for her, and I said, you know, I need to cancel our stuff for the weekend. I just think we're not going to be able to make it. So I called the hotel in New Orleans, and I'm sitting there waiting, and, you know, and finally they come on. They worked with me, and I sent a message to Commander's Palace, and they, no problem. And when I got back about 30 minutes later to the hospital, when I walked into the room number 2, it was a totally different scene. It was pandemonium in that room. There were probably 8 or 10 nurses, and they were scrambling. One of them grabbed me and says, you can't be in here. And Dr. Gonzalez was behind Britton, and she was looking at me, reaching out to me like, come here. And he said, we've got to get her into ICU right now, and we've got to get a tube in her and a breathing tube in her. And they drug me out of the room, and the nurse said, we've got to take you down to consultation down here. Well, I've been in a lot of hospitals with a lot of families in consultation rooms, and that's almost never a good sign when they take you to the consultation room. That's why there's all these boxes of Kleenexes in there. And I walked in, and there's Kristen, and she's crying, and I start crying, and we're just going, what has happened here? What is going on? In a few minutes, my brother came up, and he's a pastor also in another church, and he prayed with us, and then they came and got us, and we went up to ICU, and put us in room 23. And for the next 16 days, room 23 would be our home, and we would see so many things happen in that room, and God would do so many things. And so that day was just an incredible day of events and seeing God beginning to do some things. That's where we met our first nurse that we would really get attached to. Her name's Melania, and she's here tonight. She's from South Africa, Melania de Klerk. I asked her if she was kin to F.W. de Klerk. She said she wished, but there's, you know, they're very there's a lot of de Klerks in South Africa. And I remember being in the room with her that whole afternoon and just watching her work. And there's this incredible bank of just pumps. She was hooking her up to all these things, and they had tubes running in, and there were just tubes everywhere. And she's trying to keep those things, you know, organized and sorted out. And she did a masterful job of ministering life to our girl, and it was a surreal feeling to look down at your child who just an hour or two ago had walked in, she's talking, and now she's got a tube down her throat. She's got IVs, and they're putting a PICC line in, they're putting an A line in, she's got a catheter, and ended up being about 14 tubes when it's all said and done, going in and out of her body. I remember one moment when I was just me and Melania in the room, and a couple things she said. One thing she says, you know, she needs to hear your voice. And she just reminded me to talk to Britton, that you know, she needs to hear you. And there was one time also when, you know, she was really busy trying to keep things moving and going. And I remember seeing the blood pressure monitor, and it was 50 over 18, and the heart rate was way down. And of course, you know, I didn't know what all that meant, but she did. And there just came a moment where she kind of saw some light there, and she just looked up at me, and she just kind of did this high five, like, okay, we got through that. That was really, really intense there. And she walked out, and remembering her words, I needed to speak to Britton. I didn't know what to say. I said, what do you say? I mean, I didn't have any words. I was just at a loss. And so I pulled out my phone, and I've shared this before. And that morning, I had been, as I did my quiet time, I left off in John chapter 12, and I'd stopped at verse 14, where Jesus is entering into Jerusalem on the donkey. And in verse 15, I started reading to Britton, verse 15, chapter 12 of John. And I thought, okay, this will be good. I'll just read some scripture. And as I began to read, it was not comforting at all, because it seemed very ominous. And said, "Fear not, O daughter of Zion. Behold, your king is coming, sitting on a donkey, a colt." And I was like, well, wait a second. I don't want my daughter to see the king right now. That's not where I want to go with this. And I just kept reading to her, and I couldn't stop. It was like the Lord was just pushing me on. And as I got to verse 23, it just became so apparent that God was speaking to me. And Jesus answered and said, "The hour has come that the Son of Man should be glorified. And most assuredly I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it produces much grain." I'm sitting there going, what in the world? God, why am I reading this to this child, you know? "But he who loves his life will lose it, and he who hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, let him follow me, for where I am, there my servants will be also. If anyone serves me, him my Father will honor." And then Jesus said these words, "Now my soul is troubled." I'm sitting there thinking, okay, it's got to get better. I mean, come on, let's get to something, you know, really light. And says, "My soul is troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour." And God is speaking to me in this moment. "But for this purpose I came to this hour. Father, glorify your name." And I stopped. I closed my phone and just said, okay, I can't read anymore. And I got up and I walked out. And I'm just trying to process, like, God, what are you saying? Are you setting me up to for what's coming, that we're about to lose our daughter? Are you telling me that you're about to do something with her life, take her life, but use it for a greater purpose? And as a pastor, I've preached those things and talked about those things and read stories of missionaries who've died on the field and things like that. But I wasn't ready for that to come home. And so that whole afternoon, as we watched what was going on and those words were ringing in my heart, it was just a really difficult day. And about 6:30 that night, Chris and I walked out in the waiting room, and it was empty, which had not been that. There had been a lot of people up that day and family members, and it was just me and her, and we sat down, and we were just trying to talk about what was going on. And Dr. Gary, the pulmonologist, walked out. He came over and he sat down with us and he said, I need to talk to you guys. He said, you need to understand what we're dealing with here. He said, she is our sickest patient in the ICU. And I was like, okay, the ICU is usually, there's not like an ICU really bad place. You know, that's not like the good ICU. And then the people were, I mean, that was it. And when he says she's our sickest patient, I was like, what in the world is going on? And he said, we have done all we can do. We've been working hard all day to keep her alive, and we're just barely keeping her alive. And as he is talking, it is just like the room is just getting darker and darker. And he said, I know that you guys are Christians, and you need to have people praying for this child right now. And he got up and he walked away. And Kristen looked and she said, we've got to get people praying. She had her phone out and she's starting to text people. And I pulled my phone out and I sent this text at 7:07 to the pastor. I said, we just met. I said, Pastor, I tried to call you. And he was in a finance committee meeting. I didn't remember that, but he was there. So we just met with the doctor and things are looking very dire at this point. Would you mind sending out a request on your social media for people to pray for Britain? And I sent that out, and then I walked down the hallway, and it was dark. They'd shut the doors, and all the offices were closed, and I just wanted to find a quiet, dark place. And as I started walking down, just the emotion just began to overwhelm me. And I just began to weep like I've never wept before. And that's just not who I am. I can be an emotional person, but I'm not one who's overcome with emotion. And I just kind of lost control. And I found this kind of dark corner, the dead end of the hallway down there. And I just began to say, what? God, what are you doing? What is happening? I don't understand this. And I was so angry with God. I was like, Lord, this girl loves you. This girl has given her life to serve. She wants to be a missionary, and you're going to take her right now. I don't understand this. This makes no sense to me. And God began to speak to me and began to, in that moment, it was just a real strong moment of where God was just saying, you need to give her over to me. And I found myself saying to God, these words, Lord, you gave her to us in this very hospital, just one floor up, 18 years ago. And if you're going to take her from us in this hospital, we'll find a way to be at peace with this. If there's not a miracle for us, we'll find a way to be at peace with this. It's going to take a while. And I said, Lord, this is not my will, not what I want. It's whatever you want. And about that time, John Lowe walked around the corner, and I was not happy to see John Lowe because I wanted to be alone. And John came down the hallway, and he just said, how you doing? And I'm like, man, I'm not good. I said, I'm angry. I'm mad at God. I don't understand this. I said, if he wants to take her, I understand that. I know he can use that, but I want him to leave her here. And I'm just kind of, voicing that to John. He's just listening as a good friend. And about that time, one of our deacons came down the hallway, and he's moving pretty quick, Russ Orr. And Russ sees me. He says, Stan, they need you in the ICU. And I'm thinking, okay, that's it. She's gone. And he says, no, this is good. This is good. I'm like, well, you should have said that first. don't do that. And so a word to, if you've got to deliver a good message, tell people it's good. Okay, now they want you back there. And so I walked back, and really all day long in the ICU, we just never had a sense that they were ahead of the situation. They were chasing so many things in her body. Her kidneys had stopped working. Her liver had stopped working. I mean, her lungs had filled up. A septic shock had set in. And I mean, her blood pressure was way down. I mean, just all day long, they were chasing things, and they were giving her one medicine for this, another medicine for something else. And it just seemed that there was not a sense of control. It's like watching a flight crew on a plane. As long as they're okay and they're happy, they were good. When they start strapping in and doing this number and asking, is there someone who can pray on the plane? You're in trouble. When I walked back in, and I saw Dr. Garrett, he's kind of leaning on the counter, and he sees me, he said, she's awake, which I was shocked. And then in my mind, as a preacher and as a guy who've been in those situations, I've seen patients rally just before they go. I've seen that many times. And I'm thinking, okay, God, is this the light bulb getting bright before it goes out? And Dr. Gary says, I think we've kind of hit the bottom here with the numbers. He said, I think we've seen them begin to come up. And I walked in, and Melanie's there, and other nurses are there, and there was just a peacefulness in the room. And her eyes, and I have never wanted to see her eyes more than in that moment. And from that moment on, we began to really see. Now, it was 30 minutes from that point, from when the pastor sent out that text to people to begin to start praying. And people began to pray. and things began to happen. And every time we would put on Facebook or ask people for prayer for a specific need, we would see things happen. It was incredible. I shouldn't say it's unbelievable, because that's just a statement of my lack of faith. You know, we know our God works miracles. And when we began to see God do things, and it was amazing to watch his hand, because we were so powerless. And God began to work, and he began to use this incredible team of doctors and nurses and technicians, and he began to work through them and give them the wisdom and remind them of their med school training and help them. And we began to just see things happen in her life. And it was an incredible day. You know, and the waiting room began to fill up, and people began to show up, and some of the deacons had come up from their meeting that night in the finance committee and with the pastor, and they prayed with us. And we kind of closed that first day out with this sense that God was at work and that he was going to have the last word on all of this. And that began a six-month or six-week process that brings us to even today. We're still not done. And Britton's here tonight, and we're so thrilled that she's able to come to church. She's got, you know, still a lot of weakness and a lot of room to grow, and they've told us that it's going to take months, maybe even as much as 18 months before she's back to where she needs to be. And so the next 6 weeks, we would see all kinds of things happen. 16 days in the ICU, 9 days would be on the ventilator itself. And of course, they couldn't keep her asleep. They would, you know, give her all kind of medicine and try to keep her out. And, you know, and she's one of those people, she wants to know what's going on. She wants to know what the plan is. She wants to know, yeah, and she wants to know everything. And so they couldn't keep her asleep. And, you know, she would go through dialysis 5 times and multiple blood transfusions, and we would be watching things at times like blood gas and blood pressure and heart rate and the fever and creatinine and liver enzymes, and then she'd have something called ARDS with her lungs, and there would be the ventilator and then this big mask called the BiPAP, and it was this constant step into step into step of a new thing each day. And every day God was with us. Every day he was right there walking with us. And we felt God around us. We felt his love and presence through the people that were there. The waiting room would be filled at times with family and friends. And, you know, Bobby and John Lowe, they became like the floor generals there for a couple of weeks in the ICU waiting room. They would be organizing things, and they had a banner put out there for people to sign. And they would, you know, remind us of who came and brought food, and they'd get their names. And they were phenomenal ministers to us during that time. And we saw so many incredible things happen. And there were heroes in the ICU. Melania is here tonight, our first nurse. Jessica is here as well, and another one of the heroes. And Jessica would become fast friends with Britton. She'd, you know, come in and call her Chica and remind her that she's going to make it, and just, you know, keep her chin up. And there were so many nurses who would come in and just befriend her and do kind things for her. You know, when you're on a breathing tube for days and days and days, you know, your hygiene goes out the window, and it becomes almost intolerable for the patient. And they would find ways to make the intolerable tolerable. People like Anita and Rachel and Tessa and Ben and Brittany and Stacy and Chad. Chad was her first male nurse. I remember seeing her eyes get wide when he walked in. So I'm going to be your nurse tonight. Well, you know, I can't tell you what she said to me when he walked out. But I had to go have a conversation with Chad about taking care of a young, you know, 18-year-old patient, you know. And he's like, oh, Lord, I've done that many times. I was like, well, you've not done it for this one, okay. And she's concerned about that. And she's, you know, And of course, he ended up becoming a buddy of hers, and you know, of course, she liked to aggravate him. But you know, he was a very conscientious nurse who really looked after her. And one of the darker times, I think it was his first night, they had to put the tube back in her. We got the call at 4:15 in the morning from my sister-in-law, who was spending the night with her, and she said, they've got to put the tube back in her. She'd fought so hard the day before of trying to stay focused on her breathing, and so we got there just after they got the tube in, and she was so angry. I mean, they had her sedated, but she was fighting and fighting, and for some reason, I can speak to her, and she calms down sometimes. A lot of times, I can get her riled up. And I just said, look, honey, you've got to let the machine work for you. You've not lost the battle here. They're just giving you a chance to rest. I need the princess and not the warrior right now. Because she was in full battle mode. I mean, she was still wanting to fight, and they knew she couldn't keep fighting. You know, those were some dark days, but there were all kinds of heroes. And I tell you, the greatest heroes for us have been people who have just prayed for us. And they have just lifted our family up in prayer. People who we've never met before. People all over the world. I mean, there were people from just all kinds of different countries. Nepal, China, Israel, India, South Africa, Canada, Australia. Some of these are our friends. Some of these people we've never met. Turkey. And they were praying, and people just began to... I've never seen such a prayer movement like what happened. And it was like God just said, look, I'm gonna take this one situation. I'm going to just show my glory through it. Not that our family's special or super spiritual. And, you know, there have been all kind of teenagers who've been through similar situations, if not even worse. For some reason, God just... said, I'm going to just use this, and I'm going to bring people together in prayer. And what a privilege to see God at work and calling people to prayer and people praying for us. And I was just amazed. And I'm not a big Facebook person, but I got kind of pulled into the Facebook, you know, posting. And because I knew that was a way to get our voice out there of saying, here's some things to pray about. And I would try to be as specific as possible. And when I would put those out there, people begin to pray, and we would see things happen, specific things happen, as soon as people began to pray. And it was just amazing to watch what God did. And there were people who have been so kind to our family. They'd brought food and gift cards and banners and coffee. Boy, the Harrises, they would tank me up with coffee. You know, I mean, it's like, you're going to make me an addict after a while. You know, one of our church members, Stacy Duncan, who went through a very similar situation with septic shock, she would come up there with a suitcase full of candy and water. I mean, two or three days, she would come up with this big suitcase, dragging it up there. Other people are like, what is she dragging that suitcase for? And she'd just load up the table there in the ICU waiting room. You know, just little things. Chick-fil-A on 9 Mile, they sent this big jug of lemonade. Which Britton didn't get any of because I drank all of it. She couldn't. She was in the hospital, so somebody had to drink it. We couldn't just let it, you know, go to waste and all. So, you know, Coach Melissa, one of our church members over at UWF, the volleyball coach, her and her team would come and walk our dog. You know, I mean, he was suffering because every day I would walk him 3 to 5 miles, and all of a sudden that stopped. And, of course, him and Britton are big buddies. I mean, you know, when we brought him home the first night, she brought him in the room, and she cuddled with him and sang to him, and they kind of, you know, became close buddies there. And all of a sudden, she's gone, and he's not getting his normal attention, and he is just, you could tell he's stressed out. And those ladies would come, and they would walk him and run with him, and all these big, tall, giant girls were out there, and he had a ball with that. And just simple little things like that, that people just found ways to minister to us. Not extravagant, not elaborate, but just some wonderful gestures of love and caring. Just people being the hand of God, of just saying, hey, we can't do a lot. We can walk your dog. You know, we're going to bake you a cake. Our friends from Birmingham came down, surprised us. And they came down, and of course, she's Romanian, and she cooked a Romanian soup for us in our kitchen. And They came down that morning, brought us pizza from Kristen's favorite pizza place, went to our kitchen, cooked the soup, and drove back that same day. Just an incredible gesture of love. Heroes to us, people that we'll never forget their kindness. Family members, my brother and Kristen's brother and our sisters and, you know, in-laws and outlaws and, you know, people just showing up and just, you know, staying overnight with her and saying, we want to give you a break and we'll spend the night and we'll stay with her and just showing such incredible love and care. And, you know, those were days that got us through, because there were some frightening times. There were some dark days. I mean, just watching her, you know, fighting through dialysis and dealing with the septic shock, and all of her skin began to peel off, and she's just in this horrible condition, and you know, you go from being a person who's never even had a blood test or blood drawn to all of a sudden you've got all these things coming out of you and into you, and when she woke up, she wasn't mad or angry. She wanted to know what had happened to her. She always wants to know the details. Then she wanted to have some lemonade. But even there, God gave her grace to where we didn't see this angry, mad person. She just wanted to know, what's the plan and how do we get to where we need to go? And that was just God working in her life. And, you know, we'd take her home twice, and two times bring her back to the hospital. And those were hard days when we had to take her back, because you could see the fear of her having to be put back in the ICU and on the ventilator or the BiPAP, big mask. A lot of anxiety there. The last time we brought her to the hospital, because of fever and heart rate, she was so anxious about that. And we were heartbroken for her. And that last time in the hospital, though, I saw a difference in her. I saw a patience come in, a maturity come into her life, to where she was like, okay, I'm here. God's got me here for a reason, and I'm okay with that. Because there would be days I'd be told, look, if you give up, I can't take that. I can take anything but you losing hope. And there were days it was obvious that she was done. She just, you know, and the nurses would come in and say, we're not, you know, you've got to keep fighting, you've got to keep trying. And those were dark times, but what got us through was the grace of God and his good people coming along around us and beside us and helping us and encouraging us and sending us notes on Facebook and little cards in the mail and just dropping by the hospital to say, hey, I'm not going to stay long, I just want to say hello and we're praying for you. Those were days of setback and fatigue and frightening days, but days we knew God was with us. And there were some victories, a lot of victories, a lot of miracles. I mentioned every time we would ask for prayer, things would happen. We saw people who would message us and say, hey, we've got people who have never had any interest in God whatsoever. They're asking about this. They're wanting to know about this whole Christianity thing and about, you know, is God real? And we've gotten open doors to share our faith like with these people. We've never even had that before. I mean, so we had people all over the world praying. And I remember one day, it was a Sunday. It was the second Sunday that she was in the hospital. It was a couple of Sundays after that, and that's the day that Bob O'Shields went into the hospital. And Pastor asked me to go see Bob that morning, and so I drove over to Baptist Hospital, and I walked up, and there's the doctor talking to Wilma, and it's very obvious that he is giving her very, very grim news. And, you know, Bob was her second grade teacher here at the church, and he loves our children. And he was so kind with them. As I sat down with Wilma out in the waiting room, after she had talked to the doctor, she said, I remember your message that you preached about miracles. She said, I just don't think God's going to give us a miracle for Bob. She says, you know, God gave us such a beautiful day yesterday. We drove all over the South, just went all through Mississippi and Alabama. And it was my birthday. And we had a phenomenal time. We laughed and cut up and acted like kids and just had a beautiful time. And we got home, and 10 minutes after we got home, Bob had a stroke. And she said, you know, God's been doing something. You know, Bob had shut his business down just a few weeks ago, had given all of his clients away, and we were getting ready to put our house in the market and move back to Arkansas to be with our kids. And God's just, it was like she knew God had been preparing them for this moment. And God gave Bob that beautiful day. And a few weeks later, on February the 18th, I was going through some messages on Facebook. You know, Facebook's got all kinds of different ways to communicate. And I found another way that people try to communicate with me, and I realized there was all these messages that I'd missed. And one of them was from Bob O'Shields on January the 18th. Just a few days before Bob would pass away, Bob wrote and said, "We're praying for our special girl." And just to see, even from the grave, Bob O'Shields was still speaking encouragement to our family. What a miracle for us to see that. That God, he just let that message just kind of simmer on the back burner until we would need it and could see it. Because if I'd have seen that the day that, you know, Bob sent it, that may not have meant near as much as when I saw it a few weeks later. And I knew where Bob was. He was with the Lord. And that was a special message that God gave to our family from a dear friend. Well, I want to close tonight with the statement Britton made when she first came to and they took the tube out where she could communicate. Now, before she could talk, she was able to write some. Now, you've got to understand, me and Britton share a similar form of dyslexia, and we don't spell really well either. And so she would try to write to us, and so here's this child who can barely move her arm trying to write to us, and she's dyslexic and can't spell. And we would try to interpret what she would say to us. And so when we could finally hear her voice, that was a magical, tremendous moment for us, just to hear her voice again. And of course, her first words were, "What happened to me?" She wanted to know what had happened. And she and one of the doctors in there, she looked at him and said, "Am I going to make it?" And he kind of smiled. He said, "Yeah." He goes, "I think we've got a survivor here." She said, "Well, good. I want some lemonade." Now, there's a lot of funny stuff I could tell you, and maybe someday I'll get a chance to. And of course, you know, we had a can of lemonade for her, and then of course, when we got it out of the refrigerator, it was cold and wet, and I had those gloves on. And when Krista handed it to me to get to Britton, it slipped in my fingers and it hit the ground. It was like a bomb going off. There was lemonade all over the place. The floor was sticky. And, of course, she was mad at us because it's like, you know, I've been waiting to have just something, you know, like lemonade, and you two can't get it right, and you've dropped it. What happened to me? I can't answer all of that. I know that an illness came into her life. And I know that Romans 8:28 says that God works all things for good for those who love him and are called according to his purpose. And God's working some good through a very difficult illness. You know, I made the mistake of looking up the mortality rates of septic shock. Don't do that. It's just, you know, that was just stupid of me. Especially, I was about to go to bed, and I said, "I just want to look up septic shock." And I saw the National Institute of Health, and I'm like, "Oh my goodness, why did I do this?" You know, full septic shock, the survival rates are really, really low. And people who do survive, many of them have very debilitating injuries. Sometimes they lose limbs and fingers, toes. It's a horrible, horrible condition. But God has brought her through so much. So what happened to me? What happened is that something came into her life, something none of us could control, something that we thought was just a regular, normal illness called the flu, and it turned into something that took us on a journey for 6 months, 6 weeks. I keep saying months. It seems like a long time. And through that process, for me, and I'm only going to speak for me, I'll let her speak for herself, God taught me about his sovereignty. He taught me about his love and grace. He taught me that miracles are still real. He taught me that the church is a place of love and compassion. He taught me to trust him in a way I never thought I could, as a father looking at a child. And he showed me how deeply I did love my children. You know, when you're dealing with teenagers, there are days you're just, you know, you get, you know, okay, you know, you get kind of fed up with them. But when something like that happens, you realize how deeply you love your children. And God showed me that. And I needed to see that as a father, of how deeply I love my child. And so I learned a lot. I know that we're all still processing this, and I know that Britton is, and she will for a long time. I told her not to use the card very often of "I almost died," you know, to kind of make us feel guilty if, you know, about getting something or giving her something. I said, you can't use that often. You can use it occasionally, but don't overuse that. On her wall, and I'll end with this, is what she told me was her favorite verse. And it's hanging on the wall there and was there before she went to the hospital. And it's from Psalm number 73, verse 26. My flesh and my heart fail, but God is my strength, the strength of my heart and my portion forever. I hope that verse will sink deep in my heart, and that I, whatever I face, I will go back to that verse no matter what happens. If it's my own body that fails or if another loved one, I have to deal with that. That I can say, even though my flesh and my strength fail, God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever.